Accession number 8736, rule number 39.
Lord Harding, tape 39. You were explaining before, Lord Harding, that you were not a military governor as such. Would you be good enough to define your role, what your role actually was in Cyprus from 55 to 57?
Yes, I wasn't given a written directive, but in the conversation and discussion with the Prime Minister and the Colonial Secretary, Lennox Boyd, it was quite clear that my job, the job they wanted me to do, was twofold. First of all, not in order of priority, but simultaneously, to contain and defeat the IOCA terrorist organization, so that they were no longer an effective guerrilla force. And secondly, at the same time, to try and reach agreement, a political agreement, with the Archbishop, who was the leading political figure in the island, of course, and was also the leader of the Greek people in the island, to reach agreement with him on the future of the island. And that had one very clear constraint, and that was that in any agreement that was reached, an advance to self-government was acceptable to the British government, but it was essential from a strategic point of view for us to have full control over the whole of the island for military purposes in case of need, for the reasons that I've already given you, because of fulfilling our obligations under the Baghdad Pact and to under the Anglo-Jordanian Treaty. So that was the role, really. It was twofold. One, to contain and, if possible, defeat the terrorist organization so that it was no longer a threat to the British position in the island, and secondly, but not secondly in order of importance, but simultaneously rather, to work to reach agreement with the Greeks, Archbishop in particular, and the Turks, of course, too, on the future constitution and system of government of the island.
Now, what was the significance, the fact that you were a soldier put in as governor?
Well, I think the significance of that was that I suppose they thought that a soldier, and especially someone with experience of dealing with anti-terrorist operations as I had in Malaya, was better suited to deal with the first part of my dual role than a civilian. And that, I think, is the case, because obviously not only were the police, but the army, and to other lesser extent, but also to a considerable extent, the navy and the Royal Air Force.
So, did you go out as a civilian?
No, I went out as an individual who had been a soldier.
But you didn't wear uniform, for instance.
Well,
would that have been the case?
I don't know whether I arrived in uniform or not. I think maybe I did. I think probably I did. I don't remember. But it would have had no significance anyway. Yes, I probably did. I can't remember.
Who were you accountable to as governor of Cyprus?
Well, I was accountable I was responsible to the colonial secretary, but I also asked for and was given the right of direct access to the Prime Minister if I considered it necessary.
Were you to find that useful, you know, the fact that you had direct access?
Yes, it was, definitely, yes. And so much so, really, that when Del Templar went to Malaya, I insisted on his having the same right of access. And I suggested to Mike Carver when he was going to Rhodesia that he should do the same, but he rather spurned it. Said he would do that anyhow. No, no, it's important, because if the colonial secretary is away or on tour or on a visit, or if there's something of the very highest importance, then I think you want to be able to make your report direct to the Prime Minister.
What sort of briefing did you have prior to your appointment?
Well, I had discussions, of course, lengthy discussions with the officials at the Colonial Office and with the Foreign Office. And I talked to my own people in the War Office, of course, about it all, about the Army and its part. I also tried to find people who had experience of Greece and the Greeks, and I had talks with a chap called Marty Woodhouse, who had been with the Greek resistance movement, and was at that time a junior minister, had gone into politics and was at that time a junior minister in the Home Office. And also with another chap who'd been with the Greek resistance in Greece, and whose name escapes me now, but he was at that time, he was headmaster of Clifton School, and I actually ran into him fairly recently, and he reminded me about it. So my object really was to find out, get as much information as I could, and ideas as I could, about how the Greeks behaved, how they acted, reacted, and so on. And that was why I was particularly interested in all that Monty Woodhouse and this other chap had to tell me about their experience of the Greeks and the Greek behavior under well, not wartime conditions, but under emergency conditions, as existed, of course, for them when they were in the resistance movement. Now that was very useful. I was also, in the course of discussions with Lennox Boyd, the colonial secretary, he expressed a strong view that I ought to have as my deputy a professional colonial civil servant. And I accepted that to deal with the civil administration side of the business as my deputy. And they suggested three names, all of whom were overseas somewhere. And of the names they gave me with their dossiers, I said I thought an individual called George Sinclair, who was at that time in West Africa, in the Cameroons, I think, as a senior colonial civil servant, I said he sounded as if he would suit me best. And so they got him back urgently, flew back, and I met him and decided that he and I could work together very well, and that turned out very successful. So I said I'd like to have him, and much to his wife's annoyance, I think, at the time, he was taken away from his job in the Cameroons or wherever it was, and joined up with me, and we went out to Cyprus together. And that was the party, my wife and myself, an ADC of mine called Gibby Melgan, and George Sinclair and I. We went out together.
Did you have any previous discussions with the previous governor?
No, he was in Cyprus.
When you arrived in Cyprus, would
no,
you have had discussions?
No, he left before I arrived.
So you didn't actually meet him?
No, we didn't meet. I'd met him once before, actually, for a short time, when I was doing a tour in the Middle East before. Some time previously.
But you didn't actually gain any information, direct information on the task from him?
No. I'm not a great believer in that sort of thing.
Why is that?
I think what you want to do is to find out all you can about the situation and about the job. But you don't want to sit side by side with somebody you're taking over from. When you take over, you have to assume full responsibility, and that's that. By all means, talk beforehand, meet and discuss things. I had meetings with Hugh Foote. I think he came and had breakfast with me before he went out, and that's all.
Yes, I must ask you about that.
I don't believe in sitting side by side, if you're either in the chair and responsible or not. Anyway, there was the colonial secretary was there, and the rest of the senior government officials, all of whom, and the chief of police, and the officer commanding the army there. The military forces there. So there were plenty of people to advise me on arrival.
If I could just make absolutely certain of this, you went out as a civilian governor, Robert Armitage.
Yeah.
But was your brief any different from his? What was the difference?
Well, I said as governor, you were responsible for law and order. Any governor, I mean, whether he was a soldier, an ex-soldier, or a civilian, or whoever, the governor is responsible for law and order, for the administration of the island, and the government of the island. And that is, you call yourself a civilian governor or a military governor, I don't think there's any distinction between the two. A governor of a crown colony is responsible to His Majesty's government, as it then was, for the administration and for the law and order of the area in which he's governor, the colony.
With the situation which you have briefly described in 1955, the deteriorating situation, it would seem that your task was going to be a much more serious one than perhaps Sir Robert Armitage had when he went out there.
Well, yes, I suppose you. Oh, yes, you could certainly say that, because when you've got a situation where the law has ceased to function, and rioting and violence is current like it is now in Northern Ireland, well, it's a more difficult situation. It's different both in content, so to speak, and in purpose. Because the primary function then is to restore law and order and to make sure that the law is upheld, and that rioting, disorder, violence, terrorism is put an end to.
Could I now ask you about the Greek Cypriots and the exact problems they were causing at this particular time? Perhaps we could look at the various groupings, starting off perhaps with the Greeks to begin with.
Well, at that time, and I think the proportions, judging by reports, recent reports in the press, are about the same still. At that time, the Greeks, and I call them Greeks because a lot of people call them Greek Cypriots, but people are what they believe themselves to be, and they believe themselves to be Greek, and that is what they believed, and that is why, emotionally, they had this tremendous aspiration to be part of Greece, and that is the basic reason for Ennissus, their support of Ennissus. They are Greek. They look upon themselves as Greek. They have Greek ancestry. They look upon themselves as Greeks, and they wanted to be part of Greece, and they looked upon Greece as their homeland. That is the psychological and the emotional situation. At the same time, they are very successful and active business people. And in their heart of hearts, they fully appreciated the value, the commercial value, of connection with this country, and their enjoyment of what at that time used to be called imperial preference, as far as trade is concerned. So they were schizophrenic to some extent in that respect, in that they emotionally and typologically they wished to be Greek commercially, and financially they were anxious to retain their British connection because of the commercial advantages that that carried with it. And this is the case, I think, as of today, or was up to the time of independence, rather. There were 80%, I think, was the rough figure then. The Turkish Cypriots, as they're called, who are Turks and look upon themselves as Turks in the same way as the Greeks look upon themselves as Greece, and look to Turkey for as their motherland, and it's their sort of general guides, philosophers, and friends, they were about 18% of the population. And the other 2% were made up of Maronites, who are the Cyprus offshoot of one of the main races in the Lebanon. And they owe allegiance to the Pope of Rome, but they're not observant, under Rome in any way. They follow, they have a sort of indirect allegiance to Rome. But and they speak Aramaic, which is the language of our Lord. And they are small, there were about 2,000 of them, I think, at that time, or maybe a few more, but around about 2,000. And then there were a small Armenian community and, of course, a small and much smaller British community of British residents and so on. So that was the composition of the island, population-wise. And they were, the Greeks and the Turks were distributed all over the island. There was no one Greek part of the island and no one Turkish part of the island. There were villages which were inhabited by both Greek and Turks. There were mixed villages, mixed in the townships. In Nicosia there was a Turkish quarter and a Greek quarter. And the same in the other main centers of population, like Limassol, Larnaca, and Famagusta, for example. So they were all mixed up. The Greeks and the Turks were mixed up all over the island. And it wasn't until the Turkish invasion in 1974, of course, that they separated out like that, like they are now. But that was the setup. The Greeks were emotionally, as I've said, strongly in favor of Onassis. The Turks were frightened of Onassis. They were very afraid that if Cyprus became a Greek element, Greek country, instead of under British rule, that the Greeks would eliminate them all. They would be both victimized, terrorized, and subservient to the Greek majority. So, and the Turks in Turkey felt the same. So, the Greek population of Cyprus was strongly in favor emotionally of Onassis. The commercial elements in that population wished strongly to retain the British connection for commercial and financial reasons. The Turks were a small minority, but they had retained their own identity. They had there was no interchange or intermarriage between the two communities. And that for religious purposes, because the Turks were Muslims, the Greeks were Christians, and they didn't mix. And that's from 1878, when we took over the administration of the island, and there was a British Commissioner General, a commissioner, Evelyn Wood was the first one, also Soda, incidentally. And the British policy was to continue education on a national basis, so that there were Greek schools and there were Turkish schools. And there was only one mixed school, which was called the English School in Nicosia, which had been set up, I don't know when, but sometime, probably in the late end of the last century, which was designed, was run on the lines of an English public school on the day boys system, with some borders, and was designed and set up primarily to produce cadets for the Cyprus civil service. But otherwise, education and religion were on a communal basis, and there was no higher education on a mixed basis at all. And this, looking back on it all, was probably the biggest mistake the British administration ever made, not to set up some form, either a university college or preferably even a university, on a non-national basis for higher education. I have the view now, looking back on it all, that that had been done even as late as after the First World War. There probably would never have been an Ioka revolution, or whatever you like to call it, in Cyprus.
Because they would have developed together.
They would have developed together. Actually,
and got fairer chances of jobs, you think, the two communities.
Yeah. And, well, of course, there were both Greeks and Turks in the civil service. Denkash, the present leader of the Turkish community, was at one time in the Cyprus civil service. Grafkos Karidis, who was the main negotiator until the time that the Archbishop and he parted company in attempts to reach a settlement between the two communities, he was a lawyer, but he had served in the RAF during the war. So there's a background of complete, interchange of life, but not interchange of not intermarriage and not any change of religion between the two communities.
Could I now ask you about Ioka, this organisation? Who were the members of this organisation? Was it from the Greek side? It would seem obviously this was the case.
Oh yes, it was entirely Greek. Yeah. Well, what happened was that when Makarios was appointed to the throne of St. Barnabas, that is, made Archbishop of Cyprus. And we want to understand that the Archbishop of Cyprus is autocephalous. He doesn't owe allegiance to anyone. He's his own boss. He doesn't owe allegiance to the Archbishop in Constantinople, in Istanbul, or to the head cleric in Greece. He is what they call autocephalous. And he is also ethnarch as well as archbishop. And that means he is the political leader of the Greek community and as well as the spiritual leader. He combines the two in himself. Well, and it's called the Throne of St. Barnabas. When Makarios was made archbishop, I can't remember precisely when it was, but sometime I think about certainly in the early 50s, if not before. He decided that to start a more militant campaign for acquiring Ennissus, which is the union of the island of Cyprus, the kingdom of Greece. And he started by setting up a youth movement. And in order to organize the youth movement, he enlisted the services of Grivas, who had been born and brought up in Cyprus, and then had gone, as some Greek youths from Cyprus did, had gone into the Greek army, the Greek regular army, and served with the Greek regular army. And in the, during the Greek, the civil war in Greece between the communists and the royalists, Grivet had been in charge of a particularly ruthless right-wing group. And that was his background, and he was primarily a Cypriot by birth and upbringing. He had been in the Greek regular army, and he was a colonel in the Greek regular army. He had been a leader of one of the groups in the on the royalist, as I call it, side in the Greek Civil War, anti-communist. And he was enlisted by Makarios to come over and organize this youth movement in Cyprus, which he did, and set it up. And it wasn't a military organization, it was a civilian youth organization, with, of course, a very strong background of Greek aspirations and Greek mythology and Greek nationalism. Well, then, in 54, yes, it must have been in 54, Makarios decided to expand, extend this youth movement and turn it into a militant organization. And he got Grivas to come over and do this. And so Grivas became the leader of the IOKA, which was a guerrilla organization aimed at forcing us to leave Cyprus, to hand over the government to the Greeks, which would have directly led to their joining up with the mainland. And the other thing you must remember in that connection is that Cyprus is 400 miles from Greece, but only 40 miles from Turkey. So as this situation developed in this way, the Turks became more and more anxious about their own future. And not only the Turks in Cyprus, but the Turks in Turkey and the mainland and the Turkish government. And then it was decided, I suppose jointly by Makarios in consultation with Grivas, that he would start his guerrilla operations, his terrorist operations, and I think it was April of 55. And that is what happened. And so they started with attacks on the police stations and attempted attacks on some of the utility institutions. The attacks on the police were particularly successful. And in the course of the next few months or so, the police had been reduced.